pathetic voices would, you know, go as far, only as far as calling it a boycott. But nobody really wants to understand this as a possibility for labor militancy. Whereas we can see this now. I mean, you know, with multiple athletes saying this privately.
There's an excerpt from a new episode of The End of Sport. Find the show's 170 episode archive wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger showcasing your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Since launching in Toronto in 2006, Green Majority has become Canada's longest-running weekly environmental news hour, helping transform the environmental movement into a social justice-oriented push for a sustainable society. On this highlight from a recent episode, co-host Lauren Latour speaks with energy expert Mitchell Beer in Ottawa about the fallout from Venezuela, Trump's fossil fuel donors, EV tariffs, and more. Now, here's the show.
Hello and welcome to the Green Majority. My name is Lauren Latour. I'm your host for today. You have come to find us most likely on the radio dial at CIUT-FM, Toronto's only independent radio station on the FM dial, or perhaps you've found us via one of our podcast platforms. We are a happy and proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. You've joined us for another hour of green environment climate news. We are based out of so-called Canada, but we don't limit our news to the Canadian context specifically. And joining us today, as he does every month, is Mitchell Beer from The Energy Mix. The Energy Mix is a fantastic digital environment news platform focused on the energy transition. Mitchell joins us every month where we go over what is hip and happening and new and hot in climate news. And we're so grateful to have him here because he's always incredibly knowledgeable and brings kind of an overview of what's been happening over the last little while. So thank you so much for joining me again, Mitchell. It's always such a
Thanks
pleasure to have
you here.
Thanks
for having me as always, Lauren, and I'll try to live up to that description. Let's see how it goes.
So listeners, today we're going to be kind of running the gamut, but so we're recording this on Wednesday, January 21st. We air in a couple days. So we're keeping the conversation to sort of where it is everywhere. We're going to be talking about Venezuela, United States imperialism. We're going to be talking a little bit about the new deal that Carney struck with China that impacted a number of different areas, but namely and prominently for climate folks, it impacted EV sales. Before we sort of round things up with a bit of a conversation about the LNG glut and some news coming out of the West Coast. Mitchell, I'm gonna throw it over to you to get us started because the Energy Mix has actually the last two weekenders that you've published have been kind of on this topic. You published one the other week called Donald Trump versus the World. It's a very succinct title. And then just the other day, I believe the title was Foreign Influence Ain't What It Used to Be. What can you tell our listeners about the current state of not just the union, but the new world order, perhaps?
Well, really, the new world order, which I think is sort of like crafting itself in real time as we speak. The weekender before the two that you referred to, and this was January 3rd, was titled Lesson for Venezuela, Carney Must Make 2026 the Year of Real Security. I'm really glad that you started us off with the date and timestamp for this recording, because we're 48 hours away from air, and odds are, given the momentum all of this year and over the last week, something we talk about now is going to change fundamentally, because that's how fast it's been moving. And really, as you well know, that's the carryover from last year. When things were fast, they were chaotic, they were constantly shifting, you know, and that, you know, that sort of, you know, wild screeching sound with all of us just holding on for dear life, trying to keep up. And now here we are again. We all started the year, I would think, you know, thinking that we'd be paying a lot of attention to the backwash from the Alberta-Canada Memorandum of Understanding, November 27th, keeping up with the, you know, the various deadlines that the two heads of government at least agreed to at the end of November. And, you know, by January 3rd, 4th, right after Trump broke international law to invade another sovereign state and abduct a head of state and his spouse on trumped up charges that are now going to be heard in a New York courtroom within literally 48 to 72 hours of the new year, the scene had completely shifted. The immediate reaction that you would have expected, and you wouldn't have been disappointed from Alberta, from Premier Danielle Smith, was, oh, well, now that Venezuela has been invaded, obviously our West Coast pipeline is even more important. In fact, there are bunches of questions around why Trump invaded, what the real agenda was, whether if the idea is to get Venezuelan oil production back online, whether that'll be possible, whether anybody will be willing to pay for it, because the word was in the range of about $100 billion of investment just to pretty marginally increase their daily production. But from all of that, there's very little to suggest that this will therefore create even more urgency to extract and build a pipeline for Canadian heavy oil that people are not going to want. So I feel like the way I've just laid this out is really chaotic. And yet that's just one piece of chaos that happened in the first 100 hours of the year, all of which was followed by more news, expected or otherwise, more new developments. Trump again, threatening Canadian sovereignty and publishing a map that showed the U.S. flag overlaid over Canada, Greenland, and Venezuela. His nominated ambassador to Iceland, quote, joking about Iceland as a 52nd state. So, of course, that tells you who's the 51st. Trump threatened Greenland, and yet literally half an hour before we started this conversation, there was a breaking news report without detail, Trump claiming that he'd reached what I think we'd call a framework of a deal or a framework of an agreement to presumably get what he thinks or brainstems that he wants about Greenland. We had the strategic partnership that Canada announced with China, Prime Minister Mark Carney's speech at the World Economic Forum in Davos on January 20th, that just, by the way, earned him what is considered a very rare standing ovation at the annual World Economic Forum. So all of this, you did not hear the word climate in that. You did not much hear the word energy. We're talking big picture geopolitics that are shifting fast, mostly, I would say, in response to just the new level of crazy that Trump seems to have reached. And yeah, Everybody else scrambling around just trying to respond to it. But it really is going to shape our year. And I wouldn't recommend anyone bet on how.
No, exactly.
Unless it's just for fun, because this is way too volatile.
Well, and that's the thing. It's like you said, nowhere in that sort of high level summary that you just provided, like, was climate or environment even really evoked, except for, like, I don't know, when we first talked about the reason for Trump invading Venezuela. But it's impossible for us not to talk about these things on an environment and climate news podcast, because the impacts are going to be huge on sort of the energy system and how we are able to meet the climate moment, or in all likelihood not meet the climate moment over the next few years. Obviously, we're gonna get to the China piece later, but it's what Trump is doing and what the United States is doing is so destabilizing that it's really, really hard to know what things are going to look like you said, in a year from now. Heck, our midterms in the United States going to happen in a year from now, and I was talking with
three sleeps away, something like that. Get your countdown app and set November 3rd,
right? And I was talking with friends over the weekend, and we were trying to figure out, this was prior to Carney's much lauded speech at Davos that I've heard sort of referred to as like, Carney said the quiet part about geopolitics out loud. But anyway, we were talking about, like, what would it take for, because right now we're in a situation where the Liberal government does not appear to be taking the threat to climate especially seriously. They've done away with a bunch of regulations. They're introducing things like C15 and C5 that's really, really sort of compromising our ability to meet the climate moment. And we were talking about, like, what would it take for the average voter to become upset about this? And our consensus, although this was just like friends chatting over wine, was that we're eons away from anybody being upset enough with Carney to make climate an issue again right now in this moment, because the world is understandably so focused on this existential threat being posed to Greenland, Canada, the EU from the United States. And obviously, like, I understand why the average voter is content with Carney's actions, because he is doing a pretty good job of diversifying our strong allyships in this moment. He's showing up in a way that's really, really winning him favors with the EU, performing this tie with China. And we need that, of course, of course, yeah. of course. But it does also mean that I think climate is going to continue to take a back seat in the conversation, because when the threat is invasion from a crazy orange man, then like that needs to be that's the immediate. That's what needs to be discussed day in, day out.
I think one dimension of this is that I know there's been a conversation going on for years now, and especially in the last 2 or 3 years, we've talked about it on this show. I know we've both been in conversations about it elsewhere, about whether, you know, given the range of other issues that people are focused on. You know, people are quite rightly concerned about affordability, concerned about housing, you know, concerned about equity, and on. I mean, you know, we can, you know, do the same, you know, calling it a laundry list diminishes it, and that's the point. That these are all really important, pressing issues that we all probably care about in the climate community as well, and if not, we probably should. But if that's where people's heads are at, you know, how much more ground at a practical level will the climate community be able to cover with what I consider sort of, you know, old-fangled strategies of just hammering away at it and saying, why aren't you concerned about climate change yet, as opposed to starting out where people are at and asking a really simple question, how can I help? You know, what have we got in the climate toolbox that will help you achieve that? And it was complicated enough and challenging enough until I can give you the timestamp. I think I've done this on the show before, June 27th, 2024 at about 9:10 p.m. Eastern, when we all realized that Biden was just imploding in his debate against Trump and that Trump was going to be reelected, you know, and there were a lot of slips in between. But the direction of travel, as they like to say at the COP, was set in that moment. Right. At that point, we knew that we were going to be, you know, along with everything else on our agendas, that we were going to have to step up in defense of democracy. Because it was going to be under even more and more serious, unprecedented attack than it already was at that point. Then, when we began hearing 51st state, we realized that it was also about Canadian sovereignty. And now everything that we've seen over the last couple of weeks just intensifies that. So, on one hand, there's an excellent post that's just gone live today from the ReClimate think tank. And when I tell you that it's written by Kara Pike, who is an amazing climate communicator based in BC, you know, I'm being redundant. If you say it's by Kara, you know it's amazing. But what she's saying is that, you know, Canadians haven't given up on climate change, but just think everybody else has. And there have been a few different strands of that kind of conversation that, you know, there's been a load of polling internationally, you know, showing these huge majorities up to, you know, 89% in many jurisdictions want their government to do more about climate change. But we don't realize that we're in the majority. You know, we think we have an outlier view when it's up to 89% of us, depending on when and where. And I guess to some extent on how the question's asked.
Yeah.
But with all of that said, the most superficial but basic and important case I'll make, you know, that what Carney is focusing on right now is the first piece of climate action we need. I keep coming back to it that he was elected with one job. And that was to protect Canada and to protect Canadian sovereignty from annexation, to protect us from Trump. And if we think that there's anything else to which that can be subordinated, look at Minneapolis and let's imagine whether any of us would be able to do anything we wanted to do about climate or whatever else is on our agenda if we became a 51st state.
It was a highlight from a recent episode of Green Majority. Find new episodes every week at greenmajority.ca, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. And finally, broadcasting for more than 4 decades, Red Eye presents a progressive take on current events, produced by an independent media collective at Vancouver Co-op Radio. On this complete interview from a new episode Lawyer Kent Elson talks about the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation hearing at the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal, accusing Ottawa of systematically underfunding unreserved child and family services across Canada. Now, here's the show.
I'm Jane Williams. This is the Red Eye Podcast. You can hear our live broadcast on Saturday mornings from 10 till noon at 100.5 FM in the Lower Mainland. On the podcast today, lawyer Kent Elson on a human rights case brought by Mississaugas of the Credit Nation to challenge the lack of adequate education funding for First Nations kids on reserve. Jordan's principle is a child-first principle named in memory of Jordan River Anderson. Jordan was a First Nations child from Norway House Cree Nation in Manitoba. Born with complex medical needs, Jordan spent more than 2 years unnecessarily in hospital while the province of Manitoba and the federal government argued over who should pay for his at-home care. Jordan died in the hospital at the age of 5 years old, never having spent a day in a family home. Jordan's principle is designed to eliminate bureaucratic hurdles and ensure that funding follows the child, regardless of which government is ultimately responsible. However, First Nations across the country are reporting a major loss of funding for children's programs after the federal government changed Jordan principle rules last February. Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation have been at a hearing at the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal since October, accusing Ottawa of systematically underfunding on-reserve schools in the province. I'm joined now by lawyer Ken Elson, who's representing Mississaugas of the Credit Nation in the complaint. Hello, Kent.
Good afternoon.
Now, this complaint relates to a cut in funding for First Nations kids in Ontario following an operational bulletin from Indigenous Services Canada. What did the bulletin say?
Well, the case is actually broader. It's about education underfunding in Ontario by the federal government. And the Jordan's principle piece is just one piece of a broader puzzle. And with respect to that piece, what has happened is that the government has changed the rules, like you said, in February, and it's resulted in a drastic reduction in the support for First Nations kids from an education perspective.
How big is that funding cut?
For a six-month period before and after the change in the rules, it dropped from about $122 million down to $1 million. So it's, you know, roughly a 100-fold decline, which is really huge.
So my understanding is that services that used to be eligible are no longer eligible. Is that correct?
There's a number of factors, and some of them are not actually about eligibility at all. It's really about putting hurdles and barriers in between kids and getting the services they need, such as requiring extensive documentation that identifies each child and has a doctor's note for each child, which is really difficult if you're a school and you're trying to get services in place for September 1st. It really means that there will inevitably be delays and denials. But in addition to those hurdles and barriers, yes, there are, in essence, lists of items that are now presumptively ineligible. But if you take a step back even further, First Nations shouldn't be having to make requests for Jordan's principal funding in the first place, because they should be funded according to a stable and predictable funding mechanism, so that you don't have to be making application after application for services that would be funded through a regular budget that is planned many months in advance of the school year starting.
So it's almost like Jordan's principle is addressing fundamental inequality, but on a case-by-case basis.
A case-by-case basis. A case can involve more than one child, but it's not any way to fund an education system. It's there because there are gaps. And really what should have been happening over the past number of years is more work on closing those gaps instead of trying to plug them up with Jordan's principle. Jordan's principle is hugely beneficial. but really we should be looking to reduce the need for Jordan's principal funding in the first place.
I just want to stay with Jordan's principle for a moment longer. It's a legal requirement that provides access to supports for First Nations children in need and ensures that the government of first contact pays for the supports without delay. So how could the federal government go in and make cuts in the face of this legal requirement?
Well, that's a good question, and a question I don't have 100% of an answer to, because I don't know what's going to happen next. I'm sure that the cuts that have been made will be addressed in courts. And in fact, some of them already have been. And some of the decisions that have been made recently have been overturned by courts. But it's been more so on a case-by-case basis. And it may be that at some point in front of the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal or a court, there is a broader attack on the changes that have been implemented.
Now, the nation is saying that Canada's education funding model is inadequate. You've been saying that. And it's racially discriminatory. How big is the difference in funding levels between the two systems, on reserve and off reserve?
The gaps are very large, and we can't even provide a specific number, because part of the challenge is that there hasn't even been the kind of ground level work to assess what needs to happen to have equitable outcomes. Because we know there are pieces missing now, but we also know there are pieces that we haven't been able to identify yet. And when you start looking back into the history of reports from the Royal Commission on Aboriginal People, from Auditor Generals, you see this pattern of everyone saying the gap is so large and it's not shrinking. And then years and years and years pass and they say the same thing over and over and over again. So the gaps that we have certainly quantified are in terms of educational outcomes, which are academic results and graduation rates. And the gap is still far too large.
So the gap is huge. And then this Jordan's principle cut that's been in place for a year has even cut I don't know if I could call it a Band-Aid approach that it represented. So it's just gotten worse.
In terms of Jordan's principle, yes. I mean, the Jordan's principle funding, like I said, really should be a last resort. And even now that last resort has been cut a hundredfold.
Can you give us some examples of how this funding disparity affects families in the nation?
Well, on a broader level, it affects, well, it's really affecting kids across the province, kids in different First Nations schools, and kids attending provincial schools who live on reserve. And at a broader level, what it means is that kids don't have the resources that they need to reach their full potential. And that has a whole bunch of knock-on effects. If a child doesn't have, let's say, cultural and language and mental health supports, it could mean that they drop out of school. And it could mean leading to an unhappy life in many ways. In other cases, it can mean performance that's less than they are capable of. And they may end up in a job that is less fulfilling. They may end up earning, you know, less income. They may have less of an ability to pass on their traditions and their culture and their learning to their kids. So those are sort of the big picture impacts. And then on an individual child basis, might be a kid with special needs who does not have an educational assistant but needs them. And that has impact on that kid because they can't thrive without that additional support. And it also has an impact on the classroom that that child is in, because then the teacher for that classroom is not teaching the rest of the kids, but is having to manage, you know, a number of kids that need their own support and dealing with behavior. And so those are just some of the examples.
What is the Canadian government arguing in answer to these charges of underfunding?
Well, they're making, I guess you could say, two broad buckets of arguments. One, they argue, not surprisingly, oh, there's plenty of funding there. There's nothing to see here. But their second backup argument is that even if there is a problem with the funding, the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal doesn't have the jurisdiction to fix it because funding is determined by Parliament and Parliament is supreme. And really what that amounts to is an argument that the federal government can underfund education for First Nations kids, and there's nothing that human rights law can do about it. And it's really an argument that, you know, I can see being made 20 years ago, but in this day and age, it's, well, really, it's shameful, I think. And I think a lot of Canadians would feel the same way.
So even if the funding model is seen to be fundamentally discriminatory towards human rights, well, you don't have any authorization to do anything.
Yes.
What are the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation asking for in this case?
Well, it's important to be clear, this isn't a class action or some kind of case seeking compensation. It's really forward-looking. It's really just saying, please provide the same opportunities for First Nations kids to reach their full potential by adequately funding First Nations education. So it's very much so forward-looking. And they hope to achieve that both by getting an order or a finding of discrimination, and then also an order that First Nations education be funded in accordance with the needs of First Nations as identified in their budgetary processes, and then an ongoing process to reform the funding model.
The issue has a very long history, going back to at least 2016, when the tribunal confirmed that Canada was racially discriminating against First Nation kids for decades by chronically underfunding child and family services on reserves and in the Yukon. What's going to force the government to adequately fund education for First Nation kids?
Well, I mean, what we would really hope is that the government would have done so based on the moral and economic reasons to do so, which have existed for many, many years. And when I say moral, it's obviously just the right thing to do. And when I say economic, it's because investments in education are investments. They're not costs. They're investments because they result in a more productive and happier society. And a dollar spent results in more than a dollar of economic benefits. But if that doesn't work, it may be that orders and findings from the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal are what we will need to finally turn the page on this.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today, Kent.
It's my pleasure.
I've been speaking with lawyer Kent Elson. He's representing Mississaugas of the Credit Nation in their case before the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. You've been listening to the Red Eye Podcast, produced by an independent media collective based in Vancouver. If you enjoyed this episode, it would be great if you left a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people to find us. Also, please consider sharing this episode with a friend or telling someone about our podcast. To keep up with the show, you can subscribe to Red Eye wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you can follow us on Blue Sky at Red Eye Radio. I'm Jane Williams. Thanks for listening.
It was a new interview from Red Eye. Hear more of their high-quality public affairs and arts programming every Saturday from 10 to noon PST at CFRO 100.5 FM in Vancouver and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You can listen to Harbinger showcasing your local campus and community radio station. This episode has been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's coalition of more than 30 progressive publishers and get all your independent Canadian journalism, including news, videos, and podcasts, in one place at unrigged.ca. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now, back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
This is Bird Note. If you're looking for a way to volunteer your time to benefit birds, consider Project Nest Watch. Organized by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, Project Nest Watch is made up of volunteers around the world who monitor bird nests, reporting whether the birds successfully raise their young. Joining the project involves a bit of online training, finding a nearby bird nest, and briefly checking on it every 3 to 4 days without disturbing the birds. It's easy and fun to do, and it helps scientists keep track of how climate change and alterations to birds' habitats affect their ability to raise their young. thousands of participants in dozens of countries help Project NestWatch understand how bird parents are doing each year. And the project's website has tips for finding bird nests, building nest boxes for a species of your choice, and landscaping with bird families in mind. Studying bird nests takes time and patience, so there's great value in many people making the effort to monitor nesting birds. Learn more about Project NestWatch and other community science projects on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein. This episode is brought to you by Wild Delight Bird Food, which aims to support wild bird populations with clean, nutritious ingredients in every blend. Available at Chewy.com.
Radio Rewind.